Today in Studio 360, we're going on a Kool-Aid acid trip. Back in 1964, some young friends painted a school bus crazily and drove cross-country, hoping to take in the scenery and freak out the squares.
Every time they were stopped by the cops, and they must have been stopped at least 8 times across the country.
It's amazing.
It's amazing, and they never got busted, particularly with all those drugs in the bus.
A new film documents how Ken Kesey and his merry pranksters invented the counterculture. And later in the show, a respectable, straight-laced couple goes a little crazy themselves. Blame it on the tango.
They say, but you don't look like somebody who's danced tango. I probably look very nerdy.
I'm Kurt Anderson, that plus novelist Gary Steingart on the latest financial meltdown. All ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show, a jazz drummer talks about his love of Joni Mitchell. And a documentary filmmaker gets his hands on the amazing long-lost footage of Ken Kesey and the Merry Pranksters gallivanting across America 47 summers ago. Speaking of summer, it is the classic roller coaster season. But that's not supposed to mean the sickening ups and downs of the debt ceiling crisis in financial markets, which are feeding everybody's worries that American politics and economics have really come unraveled. The insane present moment has reminded me of Gary Steingart's latest novel, Super Sad True Love Story. Just a year ago, Steingart envisioned a near future in which the U.S. government defaults on its debt, most of it held by the Chinese. The political system pretty much collapses, and there's rioting in the streets.
Well, I made a big mistake. I had my riot happen in New York, but it's happening in London, so I got the wrong Anglo-American city. But just like in the book, the Chinese are saying, hey, big spender, you know, put away that credit card. We're about to default, which was almost word for word with what I had written in my book. It's been pretty eerie, the way things have shaped up. You know, when I wrote the book, I was thinking people thought, oh, you're talking about a future maybe 30 years away from now. I was actually thinking of 5 years, but I didn't realize it would be about 5 months.
Yeah. And so you were writing it as recently as 3 years ago?
Yeah, I was writing it in 2009. I started in 2006.
Yeah, yeah.
And everything, and you know, and my big idea was the automakers were going to fail, and you know, Lehman Brothers was going to fold. And by 2008, I had to rewrite everything. Yeah. So that's the problem with being a writer these days.
And the auto companies are doing great.
Yeah, they're doing great. I know. And I had a Northern Euro because I thought that the southern states, Italy, Spain, Portugal, would fail. So in the book, there's a Northern Euro.
That's on the road to happening.
Yeah, I'm very excited about that.
Well, as you watch, are you like the rest of us? Nauseated, horrified, panicked, or, wow, I got it right. Isn't this amusing, these end times?
Yeah, it's a combination of both. You know, I'll turn on the news, I'll vomit from nervousness, and then I'll wipe my chin and say, oh, you know, I kind of got it right. So, and then repeat. I got to stop watching the news because, you know, I think the future, we're going to sort of be a kind of oligarchy. We're going to become more and more like Russia. I always thought Russia would become more and more like America, but I think we're going to have...
We're meeting halfway.
It's so cute. You know, we're going to have a small, wealthy oligarchical class, and they're going to have a party the way the oligarchy has a party in Russia. It's called United Russia. That's Putin's party. We're going to have a party. I think we're going to call it, I don't know, the Republican Party, and everything's going to be great for that tiny elite.
I thought of you independently the other day, speaking of Russians, speaking of Putin, when he suddenly, apropos our debt ceiling, Michigas and everything else, came out and said Americans are, quote, living like parasites off the global economy. What a Putin-esque.
Yeah, when Putin calls us parasites, you know that we're in big trouble here.
Yeah. Is it the pot calling the kettle black or, you know, it takes one to know one? I don't know.
Well, look, I mean, Russia has, at this point, Moscow has more billionaires than either New York or London, which is scary.
Is that literally true?
It's literally true. Whereas, you know, the UK and the US still produce something. Russia just produces oil. And so these people who are at the top of Russia's oligarchy. They are parasites without any kind of parallel. They are amazing. I mean, they know how to suck the lifeblood out of a country. But we're getting good at it, too.
And by the way, invade Afghanistan.
And hint, hint. Those guys are just asking for it. So there are some parallels there. But, you know, look, the Soviet Union was a horrific country.
Having written Super Sad True Love Story a couple of years ago, do you appreciate in some new way the advantage that novelists have over journalists in seeing a vision of the truth ahead of time?
I think I do. You know, it's interesting because I think that nonfiction writers are constrained by the fact that they have to write, or journalists are constrained by the fact that they have to write about the present. But there's no present left anymore. The present is gone. All that's left is the future, and we're barreling headlong into this horrific future. So being able to write fiction about it, you know, being able to even project, well, I thought 5 years, but more like 5 months from now is in some ways more accurate than trying to cover the fleeting moments of today. You know, in 2006, when I started this book, if I'd been writing about the world as it was then, I'd be writing about MySpace, you know, and where the heck is MySpace now?
And the ongoing go-go real estate bubble that was making everybody rich.
Yeah. Well, in the book, New York becomes a trophy city, so only the very wealthy global elites could settle there. And then a Norwegian hedge fund buys up a huge chunk of the country, as do the Chinese. We could only hope that the Norwegians will come in and buy us up. That would be so great.
They're still rated AAA, I think.
Quadruple A. Are you kidding? They're amazing. They have so much oil and blondness. It's a boom economy.
So we haven't defaulted yet. The economy hasn't collapsed yet. Are there parts of your fictional scenario that you think will remain fiction permanently?
Yeah. Look, I think the United States is not going to collapse completely. My hope is that, you know, as China and India become the dominant powers, that we sort of segue into a nice landing position. You know, some empires land badly. The Soviet Union landed horribly. Others throughout the centuries become, you know, remember the Dutch mercantile empire?
Yeah.
If we can become Holland, where people just come here to get high, that would be wonderful.
You know? And get laid.
And get laid, yeah. I think we have so much to offer.
And drink beer.
That holy trinity of decadence, we have that to offer to the world.
Gary Steingart, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Gary Steingart is the author of the novel Super Sad True Love Story. What are you reading or watching right now to help you get through the current craziness? Tell us at studio360.org. Back in 1972, when I was 17, some friends and I got ourselves an old school bus and drove it all over North America. We went from Omaha down to Mexico City, up to San Francisco, and back home. It was like our little cover version of the original groovy school bus trip. Ken Kesey and his friends, the Merry Pranksters, crossing the U.S. back and forth in 1964.
Ken, why was the idea of a road trip so appealing?
We weren't old enough to be beatniks, and we were a little too old to be hippies. But everybody I knew had read On the Road, and it opened up the doors to us just the same way drugs did.
It gave us a new way to look at America, and it stirred us up.
That's from dozens of hours of old film footage and audio tape collected by Kesey and his crew. They intended to make their own documentary, but the film has been rusting in cans in the Kesey family barn for 4 decades. Enter Alex Gibney. Gibney is one of our most prolific documentary filmmakers. He won an Oscar in 2007 for Taxi to the Dark Side. And now he's turned the Pranksters' old footage into a new film called Magic Trip, Ken Kesey's Search for a Cool Place. It shows in America in 1964 on the precipice of huge change.
You know, this period, to think of it, the easiest way to think of it is this was the period of madmen. I mean,
yes.
This is the period of buttoned-up executives who drank lots of martinis. And it was a time that still had one foot in the 1950s. And so a brightly colored bus in that environment was something very unique. It wasn't threatening.
Right.
It was just surprising.
Well, and there's this wonderful footage among the many wonderful scenes in this documentary of them driving this bus and standing on the outside of it through Manhattan, through Mad Men Central
right.
in 1964. And as you say, people are just sort of staring in wonder and smiling.
That's right. They're having a great time. One guy you can see thinks it's sort of a jazz experience. So you can see him kind of snapping his fingers as if the bus is, you know, is beating to a certain kind of rhythm. And I guess it was. If there was a rhythm, it was beat by Neil Cassady, who was driving the bus nonstop almost.
And Neil Cassady was the basis for one of the main characters in Jack Kerouac's On the Road, which had come out 7 years earlier. And he and that book were kind of a lodestar inspiration to Kesey and these guys, right?
That's right. They very much were. And so their dream was to have Neil Cassady show up in La Honda, California and say, I'm going to drive this bus. I'm going to take care of you kids, you know.
And the dream came true.
It came true. He was a kind of a father figure. It was kind of a wacky father figure because he's a nonstop talker. He took speed. He drove the bus for 3 days straight. I think now we look at it and we're kind of horrified. But all the pranksters felt very safe when Neil was driving the bus. But he was this mythic figure.
We'd take turns riding shotgun with him so he'd have somebody to talk to while he was driving.
And I felt, and I'll tell you why it went over, because up my spine came the Kundalini again. Not the Kundalini, it's a purified, not the real Kundalini, the kind of sense you were living.
He was a radio. He just went on and on and on. It was almost impossible for him to ever shut off. He couldn't help himself. It had a lot to do with speed.
Thyroid, yes. Of this third movement, major portion, critical point.
And weirdly, we see them repeatedly stopped by police on the highway across America, and the police look around, and they're physically, and the bus is full of drugs, and they're never busted.
They're never busted. All the more surprising because Neil Cassady, the driver, didn't have a valid driver's license. So he'd bring out some piece of paper which looked like something and say, whoa, blah, 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 blah. And then all the other pranksters would run out with movie cameras and tape recorders and say, oh, we're making a movie. And that seemed to be enough every time they were stopped by the cops. And they must have been stopped at least 8 times across the country.
It's amazing.
And they never got busted, particularly with all those drugs in the bus.
I wasted your time. That's why I'm not ready.
Cassady with a white belt there talking to him. Said, oh, yeah, officer. He says, you can see what they're like back there. He said, but I'm doing my best to keep them in control.
Unloosen that thing. We were having a brief equipment.
Our instant cover was always to get the cameras out and run out and say we were making a movie.
I don't know. We don't have a camera with any film.
People didn't think we were hippies or that we were drug freaks. That wouldn't have occurred to anybody because it wasn't in the news yet.
Now, was this trip and the myth around it a big thing in your life when you were young?
When I was young, I mean, I read about it. I read about it the same way that you did. I mean, I read the Tom Wolfe book, The Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, and that was a big deal to me. And he was myth-making in that book, and he helped put them on an even bigger stage, I think. And also, Ken Kesey, to me, was a very mythic figure. I mean, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest was a great book. I loved it. As it happens, I played McMurphy in the high school version we did of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which was the play by Dale Wasserman that I guess, Kirk Douglas originally played that role on Broadway. But let me tell you, I was no Kirk Douglas.
So this footage that they made, these total rank amateurs made of themselves and their bus, has existed since the time, 47 years.
Well, they were making a movie. I mean, this was not just home movies. They thought that what this bus trip would become, they were always thinking about making it into a kind of a mythic story, but that the movie of this bus trip was going to be the new kind of novel that Ken Kesey was going to write. He had tired of the literary scene, and now his tools were going to be the movie camera and the tape recorder, and this was going to be this big movie that was going to take the country by storm.
Speaking of tape recorder, they didn't know how to work them, so you don't really have much synchronized sound.
Well, they knew how to work the tape recorder, and they knew how to work the cameras, sort of. But what they had forgotten about or never consulted the manual is that you need a sync point. You need a clapper, that thing that we all recognize from Hollywood movies. Well, that lets you sync the film after the fact. Well, they never used it.
And so Kesey lived for decades after this. Why did their film never get made?
They tried. I mean, sadly for those of us who have come after, and I think the way they cut it, I mean, they understood what the trip was about, so they put the film together and it all made sense to them. It just didn't make sense to anyone else. The key thing that we had to do first was to restore it. because it had been badly damaged. And so I persuaded the Kesey family to let UCLA Film Archives bring it down to L.A. The audio tape was also very messed up, and they would record it at different speeds, sometimes on the same tape. And because they were running the audio tape off of a generator on the bus, whenever Neil Cassady hit the gas, the tape would speed up.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah, so it was restoring that tape was problematic. But we did find some unbelievable gems that nobody, including the Kesey family, knew about.
Really? Such as?
Such as a 1960 recording. This is before the bus. Of Ken Kesey being administered a hallucinogenic drug, we think it was IT-290, very similar to LSD, by a big nurse. Now, mind you, this was before he had written or while he was in process writing One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
He was a much younger man at Stanford as a student.
Right. And now that big nurse then reappears in as Nurse Ratched. But also you get to hear on this audio tape Ken Kesey for the first time experiencing this hallucinogenic
world.
Well,
Ken Kesey and one of the first people to be tripping and talking about it in a controlled laboratory environment.
Yes, it's really delicious because every 15 minutes he turns on the woolen sack tape recorder and he refers to it and then starts to play with the words, a woolen sack, you know, as he gets higher and higher and higher.
Let's listen to a bit of that.
It's quarter to one. I'm high out of my mind. Wild color images.
There's this great colored frog of a man outside standing at the door looking at some guy's room and the guy's all teetering out of the bed there. And the guy's yelling, "Man! Hey! Hey, man!" Isn't that the most insane thing? I just realized how much the woolen sack microphone looks like a shaver. Woolen sack. Woolen sack. What a thought.
That is Ken Kesey as a 22 or 23-year-old in 1959 describing the effects, I guess, of his first psychedelic experience in a lab. I'm talking to Alec Gibney, whose documentary, The Magic Trip, that appears in. What do you make of Ken Kesey's idealism in this film, which we hear him talking about LSD, about how the right drugs could change the world in positive ways?
Well, I think he even admits at the end that that drugs weren't going to change the world, and that, as he says, something about the wonderful losers. We were destined to fail in some fundamental way, but I think they were liberating, and I think they allowed people to make connections that they might not otherwise have made. At the same time, you always have to be careful. And let's talk about Ken Kesey as a writer for a second. It wasn't like the drugs made him a writer.
Quite, kind of the opposite.
Right. I mean, he was a very disciplined writer. I mean, he would get some inspiration, like he said that he imagined the character of Chief Bromden in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest while he was on peyote. But you know, I think that, again, it opened a door for him and he walked through it. But he was a very disciplined and skilled storyteller and writer.
One of the pranksters, a woman named Jane Burton, says in her voiceover that they were on this trip, quote, a bunch of lunatics running around acting idiotic. And here I want to play a bit of the film where they're in Florida.
Oh, this is funny. I remember this really well. Being pregnant, I was miserable. It was just really hot, and there was no reason to be there, and there's nothing to do, so we did this. Somebody starts playing the saxophone for the first time. Well, they want it to sound like John Coltrane. Well, they're not gonna sound like John Coltrane. That's what made me so mad. They thought they would just because they wanted to, but you don't. It takes practice.
That take on it, more or less contemporaneous, is sort of, if not damning, demythologizing.
Definitely.
These arrogant young people thinking that they were making art just because they were cool.
No, that's absolutely right. And it testifies to a lot of the ridiculousness of the 60s that was to come. It's not one thing. It's both. And people who look back with unvarnished nostalgia get it wrong. And in fact, that's one of the most interesting things I think about Ken Kesey is that, like Bob Dylan, he was kind of a shapeshifter. As soon as the culture seemed to catch up to him, like the folkies caught up to Dylan at Newport, he then breaks out the electric guitars.
Don't follow leaders.
Yeah, no, right. Watch the parking meters. And so Kesey, too, you know, once the Haight Ashbury 60s arrives and everybody, all the merry pranksters want to go off to Woodstock in the big bus, he doesn't want to go. He feels like, no, I'm going to spend time with my family now. I'm going to go hunting. Not a thing that a lot of hippies were doing at the time.
Although it's interesting, they don't come across in many ways as the hippies that we knew of 67, 68, 69 and beyond. Why is that?
Well, because it hadn't become a fashion yet.
Right. You know, they were inventing it,
were inventing, and that's the fun part. I mean, Ken Kesey was a wrestler. He was training to be an Olympic wrestler at one point. He also played football. You know, and he believed strongly in this American idea of freedom. And he really saw this as a real American trip.
Right.
And we didn't have this division yet between the freaks and the straights.
Right.
You know, it was all part of the American enterprise.
Exactly. And here they are also. Their great goal is to go to the 1964 World's Fair.
Right.
In maybe ironically, but not so much. They really wanted to see the World's Fair.
Well, I think they really did. I think they thought it was going to be a vision of the future, and they were really looking forward to it. Now, part of that is probably the excitement of a drug taker when you're going to a place with a lot of variety and you're going to get to see, you know, DuPont's exhibit about the world through chemistry and things like that. But it turns out that that World's Fair thought it was about the future, but it was really about the past. It was about an America of the 50s that we were leaving. And they left there on a trip. You know, even the word trip really hadn't been invented yet until they kind of invented it on this one. They leave there continuing their trip, which is a trip of exploration, knowing that they're the future.
Alex Gibney, thank you very much.
Thanks, Clint. Great to be here.
Trucking, got my chips cashed in. Keep trucking like the doodah man. Together, more or less in line. Just keep trucking on, on, on.
Alex Gibney's new documentary is called Magic Trip. Ken Kesey's search for a cool place.
Arrows of neon and flashing marquees out on Main Street. Chicago, New York, Detroit, and it's all the same street.
Coming up, the tango brings new passion to a couple who really didn't think of themselves as passionate.
I probably look very nerdy. This is my personality. I don't want to be...
very showy.
Do dramatic things, do very sexy things.
That, plus a jazz tribute to Joni Mitchell, is just ahead. This is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. From time to time, we ask people about works of art that have changed their lives. Brian Blade is a jazz drummer who's toured with Bob Dylan, and he leads his own ensemble called the Fellowship Band. He grew up in Shreveport, Louisiana, where he was raised on gospel and soul and funk. But when he was 16, he heard a folk singer that showed him a new direction in life.
I'd just gotten my driver's license, you know. I had a little Volkswagen Beetle with a cassette player in it. And a dear friend of mine, he gave me actually two cassettes of Joni. One of the cassettes was Hijira. So I'm starting to drive. I'm, you know, going to high school every morning. I put that tape of Hijira in, and it immediately started, you know, Joni's words and music, it started to speak to me in a way that other music hadn't before.
I'm traveling in some vehicle. I'm sitting in some cafe. A defector from the petty wars. It shall shock love away.
the poetic descriptions, the details of almost crawling along a landscape, every tumbleweed and every cactus and even the clouds above, there was so much description emotionally in the poetry. And the harmony was different to me as well. Her harmonic sensibility, I think she would call them chords of inquiry, you know. There's a question in that sound. Unknowingly, it had quite a bit of foreshadowing in what was coming for me. I've been a touring musician for the last almost 20 years now. There's this constant, you know, I'm traveling in some vehicle, I'm sitting in some cafe. There are certain places that come into the songs, like Furry Sings the Blues, and she's talking about Memphis, Tennessee.
Oh, Furry sings the blues, bring him smoke and drink, and he'll play for you. It's mostly muttering now, and sideshow spiel. But there was one song he played I could really feel.
There's a double bill murder at the New Daisy. Well, I played at the New Daisy or a Blue Motel Room where, you know, here in Savannah it's pouring rain. Well, I've written songs, been to Savannah and stood on cobblestones while it was raining, and I feel like I stepped into some coil that she actually pre-wrote, you know. It kind of set me up.
Will you still love me when I call you up when I'm down? Here in Savannah, it's pouring rain. Palm trees in the porch light like slick.
You know, it's not about rhyme scheme or things fitting into a perfect AAB big chorus form of popular music, but it's more so a story unfolding. By hearing Hijira, it gave me that liberty of like, oh, we can drive this desert until we reach the ocean. We can take a long line, you know. I wouldn't have been able to write had I not discovered or been introduced to Joni's music.
Jazz drummer and composer Brian Blade. You can hear him play with Joni Mitchell on a track we posted at studio360.org. Michael Rayfield produced our story. Is there some musician or song or work of art that changed your life? If so, tell us about it at studio360.org, and we may feature you on the show. Yo-Wei Shaw is a public radio reporter who lives in Philadelphia. A few years back, when she was in college, her parents' relationship started to change. She figured maybe it was empty nest syndrome. But suddenly, her parents became obsessed with the tango. It wasn't just a hobby. The tango was consuming their lives. A few months ago, they invited Yo-Wei to join them on a visit to Buenos Aires, where the dance was born and very much still lives.
You know that moment when your parents turn out to be people you never thought they were?
We'll see this time how long you can keep your white jacket on.
Yeah, depending on how cold it is. Mm. Or how warm it is. Or how hot you are, Mommy.
Whoa. My mom and dad came to the U.S. from Taiwan in the 70s. They were poor graduate students, speaking little English. Now they have a big quiet house in the suburbs and a solid 401k. Basically the American dream. But something was missing.
It's just so amazing. You know, here in Buenos Aires, you talk to the superstar, my dream girls.
That something turned out to be the tango.
on YouTube. I've been watching them, follow them for 4 years, and then you actually talk to them and you see them dancing in front of you.
They've rented an apartment in Buenos Aires, and my mom is practically levitating.
The first week is just breathless, you know, just the pace is so fast. I remember one day I hit 5 spots. I'm kind of like a, you know, bumblebee.
They're just a tiny bit embarrassed, and so they've asked to be anonymous for the story. Mom wants me to call her Alejandra, after a dancer she admires. The other night, Alejandra danced with this guy called Bravo Bruno.
Bravo Bruno. Yes, he actually air kissed me. He said that, "You are wonderful." Of course, they're always sweet talking, you know. Buenos Aires, man, they're the expert in flirting.
It wasn't always like this. Before they started dancing tango, a typical evening for my parents involved watching TV or listening to Mozart.
Either lying on the sofa or lying on the bed, so it's kind of boring, actually.
Nothing wrong with it, but over the years, they didn't have much in common anymore. My dad likes science and gadgets. My mom's into shopping, going to church, and managing the family finances. Dad tried to get her into sailing, but she always complained. These are the last people you'd imagine doing the dance of passion. Especially my dad. Sebastian. People are always surprised.
They say, but you don't look like somebody who's danced tango.
He's a medical research scientist. Khaki pants, a plaid shirt, and big metal frame glasses.
I probably look very nerdy. It's just my personality. I don't want to be...
very showy.
Do dramatic things, do very sexy things.
It all began one summer a few years ago. My parents took a 2-week cruise to South America, where they offered tango lessons. When they got home, my mom started borrowing old dresses of mine to go dancing. These were the mini dresses I used to hide under a big jacket. My sisters Yome and Yolan noticed something was up too.
I come home from school, and Mommy's in her tango outfit, you know, like pink leopard print tights.
They lost a lot of weight when they started doing it.
She'll grab me as I come in through the door and start using me as a leader.
They were very excited, and they were telling me to go watch some videos on YouTube of their teachers.
They recruited 2 of my friends to tango, so I guess I stopped seeing them as much.
Okay, so it used to be before it would be opera or Rachmaninoff piano concertos, but now it's just, or business radio, but now it's just tango music. It's like tango music 24 hours a day.
My parents stepped up their commitment to tango from 1 night to 5 nights a week, and then fate struck.
In 2008, Hurricane Ike, it destroyed the roofs of our house. So they decided just, you know, why not renovate the first floor so that we could have an area just to tango?
And that's what they really did. They knocked out the wall between our living room and family room for a dance floor. When I started asking my dad about the tango, I discovered another side of him.
I didn't become an artist, and partially because my family wasn't rich enough to let me do something impractical or let me spend extra money to learn music instruments or to do art.
My scientist dad has the soul of an artist.
It's a feeling that you are communicating with another human being, not just to say hi, not just pretend to be friendly, you know, you actually have to be able to feel the music and then convert your feelings into the motion.
For my mom, on the other hand, tango is more of an outlet for her obsession with technique and details.
I like to focus on the technique first, because I know at least whether I'm doing correctly, and then how to do it artistically. I don't know. I just cannot stand watching people have a bad technique and moving on the floor.
Why not? Like, where does this come from, this perfectionism?
I don't know. I really don't know. I just feel that this is art, you know, you cannot abuse that. You cannot trash it.
And here's something I didn't expect. Now my parents have more tango problems than real life problems.
You claim that you know how to dance in close embrace. You keep on saying that I know how to dance close embrace with other women. So I'm trying to feel that,
well,
very strange.
Do they claim that?
I've never seen them fight like this. The night before, the tango instructor taught my parents a position called close embrace. It's where the couple stands facing each other chest to chest and has full or partial body contact.
You guys just kind of emerged from the bedroom and then started dancing.
We were arguing on the bed for a long time, so.
About close embrace?
The typical argument is that mommy always blame on me, okay? She said, oh, I'm not doing this correct, I'm not doing that correct. No.
For almost 40 minutes, Alejandra and Sebastian zip around barefoot in their pajamas, trying to correct each other's steps.
Please lean on me. Okay.
No, I don't lean on him.
Yes, you know, I tend to criticize and be very judgmental. And with tango, I have to learn to keep my patience and keep my temper slower.
Yeah, sometimes it hurts people's feelings. Yeah, I mean, you know, he could hurt my feelings. Perhaps before we solve the problem, we shouldn't be dancing. Yeah, shouldn't be dancing with each other.
From your daughter's perspective, seeing you guys dance together is very special for us, but has it also, I don't know, brought more romance to your marriage too? That wasn't...
I think that's probably a misconception. I'm sure some people who like to dance tango, they may be looking for romance with their partner or to meet with opposite sex friends, but not for us. I sort of feel that we are two separate professional dancers. It's like an opportunity to perform.
I don't believe him, and neither do my sisters.
I feel like they flirt a lot more when I walk in on them, like, I don't know, in the bedroom, like, they're just more giggly.
He likes to joke about how people will think that he's her dad or something, and how many men will ask her to dance.
When my parents dance together, my mom has a glow about her. A famous tango teacher named Natasha Paharov gave my parents some coaching, and she started to cry.
It really looks like you have a life full of things that you really share, and in a very deep commitment. It's really emotional. I'm just like that.
Artist.
Now I've noticed little things too. How my dad always makes sure my mom has a partner to dance with before asking someone else. How my mom tries on tango clothes for him to admire and approve. And how they never get jealous. That's love.
Yeah, I would like to die while I was dancing a tango with a beautiful woman. Okay, I just dropped that. That's the way, I think it's the best way for me to die.
Not with mommy? The beautiful...
Mommy is a beautiful tango woman, yeah.
For Studio 360, I'm Yoe Shaw.
Is there a hobby that's transformed a relationship of yours? A creative passion that brought you together or maybe pulled you apart? Tell us about it at studio360.org. Coming up, the musician Josh Ritter starts a new career track as a novelist.
It's a comedy. It's a Angel West Virginian bromance.
That's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Right after this.
What's it take to make the time drop? All these kids that think they're quick on the draw, always shooting at outlaws. Can't see nothing in front of me. Can't see nothing coming up behind.
With the 10th anniversary of the September 11th attacks approaching, and this being Studio 360, we've been thinking about all the songs and shows and movies and novels that came out of those events. In my opinion, among the best was one of the earliest, Bruce Springsteen's record, The Rising. but we want to hear from you. What are the best works that you've read or seen or heard that responded to September 11th? Let us know at studio360.org. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Now my work is done. I feel I'm owed some joy. Imogene and Abelard, I'm your homeward boy.
Josh Ritter is one of our best young singer-songwriters, and he's just published his first novel. The book is about a World War I veteran and his guardian angel. It's called Bright's Passage. Last year, Josh Ritter joined us for a live show. We talked about his work on Bright's Passage and also about his most recent album. Its title is So Runs the World Away, a line he borrowed from Hamlet.
Well, it's a beautiful scene where he's talking about watching a play. He's talking about, he says that some must watch while some must sleep, so runs the world away. And I loved, it just kind of tripped off the tongue, you know. And it really felt like it described what I was trying to write about this record.
Now, speaking of Hamlet, I guess, in terms of its darkness, I understand you had a fairly dark period yourself before you had begun writing the songs on this record.
Well, it was a moment when there were so many things were going great. You know, I've put out a bunch of records, and I've been really lucky to be a musician who can make a living playing music, and that's seems like a miracle. And I'd just gotten married. I'd moved to New York. Everything was, yeah, it was an amazing thing. And yet when I sat down to write, I just couldn't write. Nothing came. That's never been something I've ever had a problem with. I always thought, well, if it's not happening now, I just don't have anything to say. But then it just kept not happening, you know?
And then you thought of The Mummy.
Yeah.
Talk about that.
I was lying in bed one night and the garbage trucks in New York are a whole new thing to me. Like, they have, you know, they have parades all, they have their own holidays. I don't understand. The bags come out, they're blue. One of them is driving these, an armada of trucks down our street. And like 3:30 in the morning, there'll be like 34 of these. And maybe it was just the position that I was lying in. Felt very mummy-like or something. But anyway, the story came into my mind, and it was a story about a mummy who falls in love with the archaeologist who kind of revived him. And I always really loved the idea of mummies and, the you know, doing everything correctly to get this person to the right place. And I thought that was always really, you know, beautiful.
And it broke your writer's block, that...
Yeah,
it did. Middle of the night thought, thanks to the garbage men of New York.
Yeah, yes. Thank you to them. They deserve a lot.
And that became the song The Curse?
Yes, yeah.
You want to play it?
I would love to.
Great.
He opens his eyes, falls in love at first sight with the girl in the doorway. What beautiful lines, how full of life after thousands of years. What a face to wake up to. He holds back a sigh, she touches his arm,
She dusts off the bed where till now he's been sleeping. Under miles of stone, the dried fig of his heart, under scarab and bone, starts back to its beating. She carries him home in a beautiful boat. He watches the sea from a porthole in stowage. He can hear all she says as she sits by his bed. And one day his lips answer her in her own language. The days quickly pass. He loves making her laugh. The first time he moves, it's her hair that he touches. She asks, "Are you cursed?" He says, "I think that I'm cured." Then he talks of the Nile and the girls in bulrushes. Oh. In New York he is late. In a glass-covered case, he pretends he is dead. People crowd round to see him, but each night she comes round, and the two wander down the halls of the tomb that she calls a museum. Often he stops to rest, and less, then it's her that looks tired, staying up asking questions. He learns how to read from the papers that she is writing about him, and he makes corrections. It's his face on her book. More and more come to look. Families from Iowa, Upper West Siders. Then one day it's too much. He decides to get up, and as chaos ensues, he walks outside to find her. She's using a cane, and her face looks too pale, but she's happy to see him. As they walk, he supports her. She asks, "Are you cursed?" But his answer's obscured in a sandstorm of flashbulbs, rowdy reporters. Such reanimation, the two tour the nation. He gets out of limos, he meets other women. He speaks of her fondly, their nights in the museum. But she's just one more rag now, he's dragging behind him. She stops going out, she just lies there in bed, in hotels and whatever towns they are speaking. Then her face starts to set, and her hands start to fold, and one day the dried fig of her heart stops its beating. Long ago on the ship, she asked why pyramids. He said, "Think of the mass, an immense invitation." She asked, "Are you cursed?" He said, "I think that I'm cured." Then he kissed her and hoped that she'd forget that question.
Josh Ritter singing The Curse. That should, I mean, have you sold that to Hollywood yet? It's a good story.
They want it.
Josh, I understand you're not just a songwriter, but as I mentioned, you have a novel, your first novel.
Yeah.
It's called Bright's Passage. What's it about?
It's about a kid from West Virginia who goes off to the First World War and comes back home with an angel that tells him to do things.
Bad things or good things?
Well, they usually turn out. It's a comedy. It's a Angel West Virginian bromance. You know, so.
There's so many of those. Did you reach a point where you thought, what the hell am I doing in the middle?
I reached a point where I finished the first draft and I thought it was like the greatest book ever written.
Uh-oh.
And then I gave it to somebody and I just realized how terrible it was. I'd never been through that before. And like, there's a lot more words in there.
You know? Yeah, right. So, thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Chris. Thank you, everybody. Thanks. I'll do one little song. This is, I've always loved Mark Twain, and for that reason I've loved this song, but I don't know how many people equate the two, but this is a
Josh Ritter recorded live at the Jerome L. Green Performance Space in New York City. His first novel, Bright's Passage, is out right now.
Moon, river, wider than a mile. I'm crossing you in style someday.
And that is it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening, and I hope you'll listen again next week. Studio 360 is produced by PRI and WNYC. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Sean Twigg,
Rachel Greenberg,
Liz Viella.
Our theme music is by David Van Tegum, and thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon.
PRI Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
Rainbows and oh, waiting round the bend.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the actor Jeff Bridges always dabbled in music, but when he won the Oscar for playing a country singer in Crazy Heart, it was time to do it for real.
You can never imagine. You know, the turf was kind of primed for making an album. If I ever wanted to make one, now is the time.
Jeff Bridges, next time in Studio 360, from PRI and WNYC.
Golden fixtures in a
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.